Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
Mayor de Blasio is expected to sign legislation making open streets permanent.
So the guy in the Escalade thinks that where he needs to go is more important than where the person crossing the street on foot needs to go.
Cyclists don't follow the law like they're supposed to. What? That guy just went through a red light. Do you see the motor vehicles going through the red light? No, you don't.
Friendly reminder that you don't hate cities, you hate cars.
And I want to live in a city where kids can play on the street without fear of getting hit by a car.
New York was run by basically a Darth Vader-like figure, and he made every significant decision about the way that the modern infrastructure of New York was built.
New York needed a Robert Moses. Instead, we got the Robert Moses.
The notion that streets are for people is a very powerful concept.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. This is a big week for New York City. We are reopening. After more than a year of closures and shutdowns, the governor and the mayor and public health experts say it's time to get back in these streets. And so, for this week's show, we're going to do just that.
Okay. Let's get at it. Sun is shining.
I'm one of those hordes of people who found biking during the pandemic, so I decided to go out and record a bike ride to start tonight's show.
So, on my trusty steed, here I go. Boy, is it a gorgeous day out here, and everybody is out. We're tired of being in our houses in New York City.
But there's also a lot of anxiety about it all. How's this gonna go? I mean, more than 8 million of us cramming back into these streets together after so many months of so much distance. How are we going to share the space? Roughly 8,000 miles of streets, not to mention all the parks and sidewalks and plazas. Are we going to do anything different with all that space? We've got a chance to reset. And I know that my own relationship to the streets have certainly changed now that I've got this bike.
See that I am not in a bike lane. I am in the middle of a street.
I live in Eastern Brooklyn in an overwhelmingly Caribbean neighborhood, almost entirely people of color. And the neighborhood is pretty well surrounded by major traffic thoroughfares, including one big expressway.
We're just below the Jackie Robinson Parkway, and right here is a turnoff that leads up to the on-ramp for that expressway. It's sort of the big divider between our neighborhood here in Eastern Brooklyn and the bottom of Queens, Ridgewood. We are divided by a highway. That said, I'm not alone as a biker. There's a guy right in front of me. There's always bikers on these streets. It's part of what makes it feel safe. Ooh, watch the potholes. The terror is, of course, getting doored. That's what everybody always told me before I became a biker, is that one of these cars that are parked alongside me is going to fling its door open. Oh, here we go. So now there's the double-parked FedEx truck. You got a couple inches of space here, a couple feet of space here to bike in. There's always some dude who wants to double park in that space.
I rode a couple miles over to another neighborhood, Brownsville, to meet a guy who was going to take me on a biking tour of Brooklyn streets.
Oh. Hi.
How you doing?
I'm Kai.
Dave.
Nice to meet you, Dave.
We met on a corner by a community garden. And, you know, some people like to think of New Yorkers as hostile and unfriendly, but this is the most sociable place I have ever lived, especially in neighborhoods like Brownsville. If you stand on a corner for 30 seconds, somebody is going to stop and speak.
Hello, people.
Hey, how's it going?
Hello. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good, good.
You're good?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Have a good day.
Dave Colone grew up in the suburbs of Long Island. And when he moved into the city as a young man, he became a dedicated urban biker.
I am an all-year cyclist.
which you have to do to make sure that you still have your legs when the nice weather comes around, because otherwise you're going to get back on the bike in like April and you're going to just wonder why it's so difficult.
That's me. Dave's a reporter for a website called Streets Blog New York City, which is all about livable streets, or public spaces that are designed around something more than just cars.
What's the coolest thing you ever saw in the streets of New York that wasn't somebody driving a car?
One time on Bedford Avenue, I saw a guy riding his bike, sitting on the seat backwards somehow, like blasting music and like texting his friend. I don't know how he was doing it.
Riding backwards on his bike.
Riding backwards on the, yeah, I don't know how he did it.
Yes.
But God, yeah, you know, like the things you'll see. I feel like it's all very fleeting. It's like you, it's things you don't even think about.
I mean, love that, the fleetingness, the ephemera of like moments of New York City on the streets, not in a car.
Yeah, and that's.
But not everybody loves it, as Dave has learned while writing about the truly heated debates over how these streets are used.
Part of it is people think double parking is a birthright, and you just kind of get this.
Double parking is a birthright.
It's you go to a community board meeting, man, you cover enough of them, and that is what you run into. It's a little strange to me only because there are so many neighborhoods where a huge majority of people don't own cars. But then, you know, this we're in Brownsville right now, and almost 75% of the households here don't have a car. And you know, we're just looking around the street here,
yeah,
and there is nothing in at all that would allow people to do anything but drive or park a car. And there is really no reason for any street like that to exist in New York City. This is, to me, it's totally ridiculous.
We got back on our bikes so that Dave could show me the streets from his vantage point. And I gotta say, the friendly, chatty world of the Brooklyn sidewalk, it pretty quickly disappeared.
All right, let's go. Describe what you were just so enraged about.
You've got one person who clearly can't fit trying to turn through the intersection. You've got two people speeding through and a guy just leaning on the horn as if it helped anything.
Well, like, and it all goes back to that there is, I'm looking three blocks down of bumper-to-bumper traffic.
Right.
All right, so can I ask you, because this is like, right now, this is the first bike lane I've been in since I left my house. Is that a function of neglect, you think, or a function of somebody somewhere has chosen to say they don't get bike lanes over there, but here on this lovely street they get a bike lane?
I think that there is a combination of political will and also, you know, the same disinvestment that you get in anything.
Now I'm blocking the bike lanes.
Oh, there you go. So the same disinvestment that you get in social services, in, you know, street painting, is the same kind of disinvestment you're going to get in safe streets, you know.
Which is why Dave has been trying to take mayoral candidates on rides like this. It's an election year here in New York City, an important one. And the battle over how we use our streets has become a prominent part of the conversation since the pandemic. Dave got one of the top-tier candidates to ride with him, Catherine Garcia, who just got a big endorsement from the New York Times. And he was impressed with her detailed understanding of what's happening out in these streets. And he got a couple other candidates, too, but none of the frontrunners yet. He sees these rides as a way to have big idea conversations.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what is the street? It's one of the mayoral candidates who I took a bike ride with, Art Chang, while we were riding. He said to me, you know, everything. He pointed out, he said, from curb to curb, that all belongs to the city. And he was like, what do we do with it?
Good grief, another semi.
I get a pretty clear idea of the current answer to that question as we bike further south into another predominantly Black and Latino neighborhood.
We are in the street with the semis now. Woo! I would not bike if that was my routine.
But finally, we make it over to Prospect Park, one of the great parks of the world, I gotta say. And we tool around in the really quite pleasant bike lanes around the park. We eventually find a bench to sit and talk about what felt like a brush with death when I was fighting those semis.
I've been run over, so I've already crossed that bridge.
You've been run over? You've been hit by a car?
I have been hit by two cars, and I have been run over by one.
What happened?
I don't actually remember, because I wasn't wearing a helmet, but turns out, I guess it's probably for the best, because you don't want to remember something so traumatic, but the police report doesn't tell you a lot. The police report just says, guy's driving, and he felt a thump under his car, and he got out, and well, there he was. There's a cop told my dad that a witness at the scene said that I was going around a double-parked car, and this guy clearly wasn't looking, and knocked me, you know, into traffic, and then I got run over by this other guy. So I broke the ankle, collarbone, eye socket, had a concussion, had some road rash, broke a tooth. It was bad.
We're sitting in front of exactly the kind of urban design that would have prevented this whole thing. It's a protected bike lane, one that's separated from traffic by a series of pillars. On the opposite side of the park, there's actually a bike lane that runs between the curb and the parked cars. So the cars become protection from the traffic rather than pushing you into traffic. New York was the first place in the country to use that idea. It happened during the Bloomberg administration. As New Yorkers, we have, I think, we're all very combative about how we should use our streets, I think, and feel very passionate about it. I certainly think so. But at the same time, I have this notion that we're way better than anybody else, you know? What's true?
I think that we do better than a lot of places in America, in part thanks to the subway and the bus network. But there hasn't been kind of a citywide, here's the vision that we're working towards. And that is going to be up to the next mayor and the next city council to really put together.
And this is, it's the absence of that citywide plan that leads to the kind of inequity that I discovered when I start biking then, is that, like, because it's sort of catch-as-you-catch-can in whatever neighborhood or street you're on, as opposed to something that's been planned publicly and citywide.
Yeah, and you know, it results in, I said I was going to show you this map of what you would call the guy called Class 1 bike lanes.
I'm looking at an image of all the protected bike lanes in the city, like the one we're sitting alongside now, and they show up as green lines on this map.
And you can see Manhattan, you're doing great.
Right.
You get up the kind of into northern Manhattan. But then you look everywhere else. I mean, the Bronx.
Yeah.
It's a joke.
Wow. There's one green line all the way through the Bronx. One straight line. That's it. New Yorkers have been fighting over space in the streets for as long as we have had streets. But it was nearly 15 years ago that Michael Bloomberg's administration began trying to reclaim space from cars for protected bike lanes and pedestrian plazas and the like. But Bloomberg's administration also oversaw rabid gentrification. And to some people, when you see stuff like new bike lanes in your neighborhood, it's also a sign that rich white people are coming to push you out. Like Robert Moses is showing up in hipster drag.
We had, you know, Robert Moses got to kind of run the traffic game here for 40 years or something like
that. Yeah.
And it's not all his fault. Plenty of people have hid behind, oh, geez, did you see what Robert Moses did to this place? But I think that in the emerging fight to make things better, I don't represent a majority. And I'm fine with that. But I think that there is an understanding of people who, you know, a new generation of people who, they don't say Park Slope has a bike lane, and so bike lanes are gentrification. They say Park Slope has a bike lane, so I want a fucking bike. And I think that's an interesting sea change.
Coming up, the long, long story of our changing attitudes about our most shared public space. I'll talk with somebody who's been studying New York streets since the 60s, as a cab driver, as a city engineer, and as a journalist. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. We'll be right back.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Tell me one pet peeve you have about New York City streets.
That they're really dirty.
When people don't pick up after the animals.
Bird poop.
I hate people that slows down in front of me.
And you gotta be crisscrossing and playing Frogger.
I hate zigzagging. I've been like, just keep it moving. Stop looking around and keep it moving.
It's always bothered me, like, how much space we give to cars and how little space we give to pedestrians, especially given how many people get around by subway or by walking.
Cars zooming across the double line to get around the double parked cars on the sides.
Because, you know, it's a lot of cars that don't care.
Some of the sidewalks are, like, super narrow, which is a problem. Like, garbage piles up, you know, things get in the way.
They blocking the sidewalk. They see you coming, but yet they won't get out the way.
The limousines are sitting idling for hours at a time.
You know, everybody be outside. Things get hot. Everybody want to get real tough. Stop that tough shit.
Finding a usable bathroom has been challenging.
That's a little bit of what New Yorkers have been telling us about how we want to share our space. And I'm joined now by someone who spent so much time in that debate over how we're going to use these streets. He's become synonymous with it. Sam Schwartz, a.k.a. Gridlock Sam, began driving a New York City taxi in 1967. He went on to join Mayor John Lindsay's traffic department in 1971 and served at least three mayors, maybe more, as an engineer trying to figure out how we can best share space and move around this packed town. Sam, I am so thrilled that you're joining us tonight.
Kai, thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So we got to start with your famous name. We got a lot of ground to cover, but I have to squeeze in that story. You're credited with inventing the word gridlock back when you were the city's chief engineer for traffic during the 1980 transit strike. I think the Times essentially gave you that nickname. How did it happen?
Well, I didn't even know I made up a word, Kai. I called it two words. I called it gridlock. And 14 years earlier, there was a transit strike, and it was a mess. The police had control of handling the city's response. In 1980, I wanted the traffic scientists to have control. So I needed to create something that City Hall could be afraid of. So I called it gridlock, two words, and I had a gridlock prevention plan. And soon the media caught on to the word, made it one word. And before you know it, dictionaries, encyclopedias, and others started calling me, where did this word come from?
Gridlock Sam. Well, it works for me. Let's start our tour through the history way back in time, even before Robert Moses. Who were the streets for, let's say, like before the 1880s? How did people in New York City use public space back then?
Yeah, it was the pedestrian. The pedestrian was king and queen. There were streetcars, but even by 1900, the turn of the 20th century, I love this quote by the police commissioner, William McAdoo, who said, "The pedestrian has the first right on roadways as well as sidewalks." So for those years, pedestrians absolutely had the right to be wherever they wanted, to walk in a straight line. And then along comes the early 20th century, the car starts growing, and we make a pretty serious mistake. And it's not just us, it's all across the U.S. We decide the pedestrian is no longer king and queen. And we suddenly create these rules for them. Now, imagine yourself back in 1910. You've been walking as a biped for millions of years. You always walk in a straight line. And suddenly somebody comes along and says, I'm going to shine a red light in your face and you have to stop. And then I'm going to shine a different color, a green light, and you can go. And when you walk, you can only walk along buildings. And you can only cross at right angles. And if you don't do that, we're going to throw you in jail. And we're going to call it jaywalking. So something happened between 1910 and 1930 that was terrible across the United States. We gave up our streets to these machines. And I use the word machines because that's the word that the police commissioner used at the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. He recognized these were machines speeding through human bodies.
And is that, I mean, I imagine this history is long and complicated, but like in that 20-year period, I mean, is that owing to the power of the auto industry? Is that owing to the power of the predecessors of Robert Moses, who we'll get to in a minute? What is that owing to that we made that choice?
Yeah, you know, we can blame, of course, the automobile industry, and ultimately they were convicted in the late 1940s of destroying transit and all over the place, but the modernists. If you looked at the modernists in the 1910s, 1920s, they said a modern city is a fast city. And the car was supported, roads, road building and the car and faster cars by almost every major newspaper, the New York Times, by good government societies like the Regional Plan Association. Full disclosure, I'm a board member. But it wasn't just the automobile industry. It was the city planners
who wanted to be modern and current. Well, so then along comes Robert Moses, who I guess is sort of the iconic version of that, you know, and we so associate him with the way with New York City in particular being car-centric and a way the highways cut off neighborhoods like mine. You've written about watching that change as a Brooklyn native, I believe, what it did to the city. What was that like?
Yeah, you know, I started out in Brownsville, 1947, and grew up mostly in Bensonhurst, lived in Park Slope, and raised my family in Flatbush and other parts of Brooklyn. So, yeah, I did watch that. I watched the Gowanus go from a parkway to an expressway, and I watched highways popping up, signs saying this highway will be completed by 1958, 1961, 1963. And they kept their promise. As a kid, I loved to ride my bike in Bensonhurst to Bay Ridge and take the ferry across to Staten Island. And then I saw this bridge going up, and I couldn't wait to take my bike across the bridge. The bridge opened, I think it was 1964, and I went there on day one with my friend Gerard Sopian, who went on to be the bike coordinator for New York City DOT. And we started to ride up the bridge and we returned back. No bikes.
Oh, wow.
And we entered into a period. If you look at every major bridge built before 1910, they were generous with pedestrians, generous with bicycles, and they all had tracks. Not a single bridge built after 1910 had tracks in New York City. And it wasn't just Robert Moses, but he built most of those bridges post-1910, but even the George Washington Bridge, which was planned with tracks. They didn't have tracks, and they made it terrible for walkers and terrible for bike riders. And the Verrazano, the last of the Moses bridges, you can't even walk across. Imagine that view that can only be enjoyed when you're stuck in traffic.
You know, it's also interesting. I've seen a stat that you cite about how many people were able to move across the Brooklyn Bridge before and after cars. Do you know that off the top of your head? Can you share that?
Yeah, sure. The Brooklyn Bridge when it opened was for trolleys and for people to walk across and some bike riders. And there was a little carriageway on the outside in 1883. And by the way, Kai, there was a toll on the bridge.
In 1883?
And the bridge, in 1883, there was a toll. They were removed in 1911. People are complaining to me now about congestion pricing. We had tolls on the East River bridges until 1911. But the Brooklyn Bridge, by the turn of the century, was moving over 400,000 people a day. And then came the 1920s and 1930s. They said, wait a second, this bridge needs to be modern. So what is a modern bridge? We're going to remove the tracks and replace them with car lanes. So we get through doing that by the end of the 1940s, a bridge that handled 400,000 people, the modern bridge was handling 170,000 people. Mm. So much for modernization.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just remarkably less inefficient. But so you worked with Moses, or at least some of his team, I believe, and you've said it's too easy to blame them alone.
Yeah. In fact, because if you look around the country, you'll see the same thing happened in city after city. Now, we were the earliest in a way of building a whole network, and that, yes, Robert Moses is responsible, and then for this crazy idea, and it wasn't just Moses, to create highways that were for cars only, and we put the trucks on the streets, and we're still suffering for that, like the Belt Parkway. But I'm going to say something that may sound a little bit odd in this conversation, Kai, and that is, of the 25 largest cities in the United States, only New York City does not have an interstate going through its central business district, and we have Robert Moses to thank for that.
Because he said that's a bad idea.
No, he wanted to do it, but he activated the anti-car and anti-highway people in the 1950s and early 60s. So by the time the big money came from the 1956 Interstate Defense Network, 90%, 90-10 money, it was the easiest investment. Every place was building highways all over. The anti-highway people destroyed Moses' plans for interstate highways to go, a 10-lane highway, to go from the Manhattan Bridge out to the Holland Tunnel. 10 lanes cutting right through Soho from the Williamsburg Bridge as well. Another 10-lane, 8 to 10-lane highway at around 30th Street. Both of those highways were killed. They were killed ultimately by the first mayor I served, John Lindsay. And can you imagine today if we had that 10-lane highway, people would say, how can we live without it? But we are thriving without it. We had record numbers of people, over 4 million people coming into our central business district daily right before COVID. So we can manage without all these car lanes.
You worked for Lindsay. You worked for Abe Beame. You worked for Mayor Koch. What? He was the first one back in the 80s to try to build bike lanes, and he was kind of ran out of town about it, or at least people really didn't like it. What happened then? What compelled Koch to build those bike lanes, and why did he end up taking them out?
You know, it was 1980, and I remember it like yesterday. And he had gone to Beijing, and he came back, and he was saying, "I love these bike lanes." And then we had the transit strike, and New Yorkers. Until then, it was just a few hardcore riders and kids. It was viewed as a toy. People just took out their old bikes and they were riding. And we had bike lanes in Midtown going up 6th Avenue and down 5th and on Broadway and 7th. And after the strike, you know, people said, you guys were like heroes. You managed things so great. And so Ed Koch said to me, I want you to do some of those things. So we tried some car restrictions. We were sued by the AAA and the Garage Board of Trade, a form of congestion pricing. The city lost the suit, but the bike lanes we implemented. So we put physically separated bike lanes, the first time anywhere, you know, in the United States. We took lanes away from cars on 6th Avenue, on 7th Broadway into 5th Avenue from Central Park to Washington Square Park, and they were in for about a month. And everybody was complaining about them. One cold morning, I get called in a November morning to Ed Koch's office, and he says to me, he can't go anywhere in the city without people complaining about the bike lane. And he said, I was just in the president's limousine. It was Jimmy Carter was president at the time. I think he had maybe just lost, and the governor was Hugh Carey, and we're riding up 6th Avenue in the president's limousine. And Hugh Carey says to the president, Mr. President, look out the window. They were riding up 6th. And he points at the bike lane and he said, look how Ed is pissing away your money. And I knew I was dead at that moment, and I had to remove the bike lanes.
Wow. Well, one of the things you've talked about is pedestrian first planning, like not bikes, not cars, not anything with wheels, but like pedestrian first. So what does that look like? What are some concrete things that cities could do to achieve that?
First of all, get rid of jaywalking laws. Jaywalking is, it's overwhelmingly used against people of color. A couple of years ago, looking at the numbers, over 90% of the jaywalking violations were for people of color.
Surprise.
They don't work. It turns out Los Angeles, which has tougher jaywalking laws, really arrests people far more than New York, and has so fewer pedestrians. More pedestrians get killed in Los Angeles than in New York City. The chaos that pedestrians offer and the fact that pedestrians look more carefully, we have a lower pedestrian casualty rate. I would widen a lot of sidewalks. You know, I love the modernists in 1910, there's an article, 1909, New York Times talks about how we're going to take those wonderful sidewalks of Fifth Avenue and we're going to turn them into two car lanes that were carved out of the sidewalks on Fifth Avenue in Midtown to modernize. We should go back, look at where all our sidewalks were, and we'll find that they all were way out. They were much wider, and we could have outdoor restaurants, more room for pedestrians, shorter distance to cross streets, which means less exposure for the pedestrian, bike lanes. We have to figure out a way to get trucks and deliveries in, but we could do that temporarily. So there are solutions there, but the pedestrian should be returned rightfully to become king and queen. But Kai, I am worried. The autonomous vehicle industry is coming, and it works perfectly, these autonomous vehicles, except for people. When you put people in the mix, it doesn't work. Oh. And they're going to do the same thing that was done to us with jaywalking laws and red lights in our face in the next 10 years. They're already talking about it. Princeton team said we need to wear radar shirts so the cars can detect us. And MIT said we need to have some devices that let the cars know what our intentions are. So pedestrians first, but I'm worried.
We will come back to that topic in a future show. Before I let you go, though, you mentioned the racial inequity in the arrests around jaywalking. But what about just in general the inequity that I saw on my bike ride? We played earlier in the show here, where it just felt like, you know, across coming from my neighborhood going west, they were totally different cities to bike in. How does that come to be?
Well, I didn't see it, so I'm sorry, but you know, we have different communities have different attitudes towards biking, and many of the bike lanes require parking to be taken. And the people who there's a saying in planning that the people who get hurt by something or oppose something scream louder than the supporters sing. So the supporters need to get out there, and they are getting out there. There's a big constituency now. The bike lanes of 1980 would not have been removed if we had the kind of constituency we have there now. But traffic equity is really important. And we've got to take a lot of traffic functions out of the police department. And that was started in 1973 by a black cop, Benjamin Ward, who took a lot of the police functions, and he became police commissioner when I became traffic commissioner. And I had over 2,000 traffic agents and cops on loan. And an enforcement body that reflected the city of New York. I think we need to go back to days like that.
Well, we got to leave it there. Sam Schwartz, a.k.a. Gridlock Sam, has been studying our streets for more than 50 years. He still writes a traffic column for the New York Daily News, among many other things he's up to. Check him out at gridlocksam.com. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Kai. A pleasure.
Coming up, I'll talk with WNYC reporter Stephen Nesson about how Mayor de Blasio has handled the streets and what the next mayor's going to face. But first, here's a little more of what we heard this week when we roamed around the city with our microphones.
What
would you want those streets to look like? You know, in your wildest dreams, right?
Let me think. To look clean so I could have a nice walk.
Mm-hmm. Very clean and not like they are now.
More open spaces, you know, for people to play in and stuff like that.
A lot more open space for people to get around by foot.
More skate parks, more bike parks and stuff like that.
Like more greenery, less pavement.
Community coming together to clean up the street, making their environment look nice. The trees blossoming.
To have a reunion and have a barbecue and, you know, bring back old timers.
Art and music, kids doing chalk on the sidewalk or like blowing bubbles.
But not blocking the sidewalk.
More like stop signs, you know? More like bike lanes, you know what I'm saying?
We have human-powered vehicles. We're going faster than people who walk, but we're going slower than people who bike. If there were just a narrow lane just for those, it would be heaven.
Look at them. They're just chilling. They're walking, having a good day. He's walking his baby.
Exactly. Walking peacefully, you know, peacefully.
I'm Kai Wright. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Carolyn Adams, a producer on the United States of Anxiety. As we reimagine what our streets and public spaces could look like, we have to ask, how much faith do you have in the government and its ability to improve your quality of life? And what happens if or when a community is harmed in the process? In this week's show notes, we've got two companion listens that address these questions. One of them is called Government, a Love-Hate Story. And the episode is all about the complex feelings that many of us have about the role that government plays in our lives. So when you finish listening to this episode, check them out and let us know what you think on Twitter using the hashtag USofAnxiety or email us a voice note to anxiety@wnyc.org.
So this open streets program we've seen around the city during COVID, what do you think about it?
I've actually really liked the concept of outdoor dining that we have.
Staying inside was a little overwhelming for the past year and some change, so it's good that they open it up and everybody get to greet everybody.
I've enjoyed the block party atmosphere.
It's the gift and the curse once again because I drive, so me trying to commute through certain blocks, it's harder because of the streets being blocked off, but at the same time, there's nothing wrong with good exercise, so park the car, take a walk.
What differences do you notice in the streets in your neighborhood versus other neighborhoods?
My side of town, like in Bedford-Stuyvesant, like, there's no streets like this, so it's like you have to walk in close proximity of people.
A lot of, like, neighborhoods where we're at, you'll see garbage, and for us, it's normal, you know? But you go to Manhattan, it's not like that.
Everybody's, like, concerned about Queens and Brooklyn and Manhattan, but we live in the Bronx. We need more attention. We need people to focus more on us.
And some people get ridiculous. You can't walk down the street without, you know, getting into a fight in certain places.
The homeless population. Very sad. Find homes for the homeless.
Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. We are talking about the streets tonight. New York City all but fully reopens this week. And tonight, we resume 24-hour subway service. So the city that never sleeps is back awake. And WNYC's veteran transportation reporter Stephen Nesson will be out there on the trains with you. Stephen, hey.
Hey, Kai. How's it going?
So, well, I'm good. I'm worried about you. Are you excited? Are you nervous? What's your feeling about this moment of reopening as someone who's been observing just how New Yorkers get around and interact for all these years?
Yeah, I'm very cautiously optimistic. I was out this weekend and the streets were just booming with people.
Right.
The mood seemed really jubilant and, you know, looming sort of over this subway opening is, you know, there have been a rash of sort of random attacks and stabbings. And, you know, there's been a real like discussion about is crime up in the subways? Is it down? Like mm-hmm. the number of ridership is way down. There's only like 2 million riders compared to more than 5 million what it was, you know, before the pandemic. So considering how few people there are a lot of crimes happening in the subway. But, you know, the city is like, we're open. It's safe. Get out there. Feel good. Ride the subway. You know, COVID is, you know, on the wane. So, you know, there's this sense that people are just ready to get out and get back to their old lives as much as they can at this point. So I'm excited to see what's happening. I'm curious who's riding the subway at 2, 3 a.m. other than essential workers that sort of been shoved off onto buses and Ubers or however they need to get around late at night.
Well, we shall see. If you see Steven out there, hit him up. Tell him why you're there. So let's talk about, as you say, COVID's waning. We've got a mayoral race coming. Let's first talk about our current mayor, Mayor de Blasio, and how he has done in his tenure. One of the big changes during the pandemic has been the Open Streets Initiative, which allows for outdoor dining, among other things. And last week, the mayor signed a bill that makes that program permanent. So how's it worked thus far? Is it considered a success, or is it making drivers nuts, or both?
I mean, I think by and large, you know, residents of New York City generally love it. You know, eating outdoors is great. It's given restaurants, you know, during the worst of the pandemic, the opportunity to actually have customers eating, you know, not indoors, but the sort of like semi-outdoor indoor thing. So that's been great, I think, for a lot of businesses to keep them afloat. As far as like streets go, you know, we've definitely seen a few random cars crashing into outdoor dining structures, but that hasn't been like, you know, it's not a persistent problem. It happened a few random times. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, the mayor put some money into sort of making it permanent. I think a lot of people would like to see more money into making it more permanent. And, you know, a lot of folks point out, sure, a few parking spaces were taken during, you know, to do the open restaurants. And, you know, the world did not collapse. Yeah. Drivers, I mean, still found a place to park their cars.
How do you think? I mean, has the city's mood or attitude about this shifted at all in the last year, you think, because of that?
I think so. I think, you know, we've seen that you can remove a few parking places and make room for pedestrians. And, you know, it's not the end of the world. Cars still have a place to park. And it makes the city more livable for more people. You can see like 20 people using up two parking spaces as opposed to like two cars sitting there. So I think that sense of how streets are used and appreciating and respecting and not minding, that has been a cultural shift during the pandemic for sure.
So what about Vision Zero, which is another de Blasio initiative, which the mayor has touted as a success? First off, what is it? It's not only a New York thing, but for people who've never heard of it, give us the quick synopsis of what Vision Zero is.
Sure. So first of all, Vision Zero, like the phrase, the name, the idea is that you can reduce all traffic deaths in your city to nothing, to zero, through smart street design, smart infrastructure. The first place was in Sweden. And other cities around the world have done this. Oslo, which certainly is not the size of New York City, but, you know, I believe in 2019, they had zero traffic deaths. That means no pedestrian was hit and killed by a vehicle. No biker was hit and killed by a vehicle. And it's sort of this ambitious goal. And for de Blasio, when he launched it, he set the year 2024 as the goal for New York City to get to zero traffic deaths. I think actually Chicago was the first city in America to launch it. New York was second. Mm-hmm. But since then, there have been several other cities that have sort of signed on to this pledge. And I suppose it's like a commitment, but it's like we're going to build towards that commitment through, you know, lowering speed limits and redesigning the streets in a way that makes them safer for pedestrians and cyclists.
And so, you know, as I said, the mayor has said it's been a success. Advocates say it has not been a success. Certainly, we are not at zero. We can say that. From your perspective, one of the things I'm curious, one, what do you think? Has it been a success or not? And two, is there any data about where the ongoing deaths and injuries occur in terms of particular racial and economic equity? Again, you know, I took this bike tour at the start of the show that I it's very stark to me as you move from Black and brown East Brooklyn through to increasingly white West Brooklyn, how much more dangerous it gets coming back my direction. So what do data show us in that terms, and overall, how would you rate the program?
Well, I mean, first of all, before Vision Zero, there wasn't an ambitious effort, like a focus on traffic safety like this. Like you guys talked about Bloomberg putting in some bike lanes before. But as I understand it, you know, Bloomberg's interest in creating bike lanes and safer, like those pedestrian plazas in Times Square, that was like an environmental thing. That was something to like beautify New York and make us, you know, a so-called world-class city. That wasn't necessarily a focus on traffic safety.
Which is how it became associated with gentrification instead of something for safety.
Exactly. And this idea that you can, you know, that all traffic deaths are preventable is actually pretty radical. And someone just explained it to me. It's like, you know, it's like drunk driving. You know, when there before there was Mothers Against drunk driving was just sort of like, you know, an unfortunate consequence when someone dies of drunk driving. You know, it wasn't something that you had to like actually work to prevent. So like Vision Zero is this idea that, you know, all the any traffic death is preventable through good street design, you know, whether it's like slowing the speed limit, like the mayor did lower the speed limit on city streets from 30 to 25 miles per hour. And, you know, every mile per hour you reduce the speed limit, you know, and if someone is hit, you know, there's less chance that it'll be a fatal hit. Things like that. That was big. I mean, people were fighting tooth and nail over the speed limit, and now it's 25 and, you know, they want to lower it even more. Speed cameras, you know, we did not have as many speed cameras before de Blasio as we do now. You know, it started slow with speed cameras around school zones. They were only allowed to operate during school hours. It's since expanded the number of cameras and the hours they're allowed to operate. Those are pretty big shifts. You know, we didn't have that before, and it did do a lot to reduce traffic deaths. I don't know if they were quite cut in half, but, you know, significantly down from what they were before Vision Zero launched. So in that regard, those are pretty big changes to the streetscape of New York City and making people safer.
We're a couple of weeks away from a hugely consequential mayoral election, and you have just published a story in Gothamist with an overview of the leading candidates' ideas on safe streets. How big of a deal is the mayor's office, you know, for this debate right now and for the debate over safe streets right now? And then what have you learned about, like, what kind of leadership does and does not work from the mayor's office?
Interesting. Well, I think, you know, having a mayor that is focused on this issue is key. You know, it's interesting, like reducing the speed limit is actually something that Albany has to approve, but it's not going to happen if the mayor isn't fighting for it, you know, isn't fighting hard. Same with the speed, with the initial, you know, the speed cameras outside of schools. You have to fight Albany to get it done, but you need that push coming from the city, the backing of the city. And, you know, there's just the fact that mayoral candidates are even talking about biking and bike lanes, Kai, is radical. You know, when, you know, I was just reading how when de Blasio first ran for mayor, it was, you know, him and Anthony Weiner, and it was that whole mess. And you may remember that, but like, you know, when they talked about bike lanes back then, it was like a joke. They were like, I think we're going to rip out the bike lanes Bloomberg put in there. And now candidates are saying we're going to put in 250 miles in the first 4 years, 300 miles. So just the fact that they're even like going as far to like back the idea of bike lanes is a huge shift from where we were, you know, 8 years ago. But you know, that said, there's some daylight on the candidates as far as where they stand on, bike lanes and pedestrian safety and how far they're willing to go and how knowledgeable they are about what, you know, they can do in their job to make changes.
You can go to Gothamist.com to find all of just a full layout of what each candidate is saying on this from Stephen. But quickly, in our last minute, what would you say is the big contours of the race?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with not so much traffic, but policing. I think it has a lot to do with how we're going to treat the NYPD. There's a lot of daylight on the candidates on that issue. And that does come back to street safety, because a lot of people believe the NYPD should not be involved in investigating collisions at all. And that they don't do enough. They don't follow through enough. So it's not, you know, it's not as much of a motivation for people to not be reckless, because they're not even getting penalized for the for the crashes or injuries they are causing. But as far as the mayor's race, it is going to be fascinating to see, you know, where they go on this issue. And as far as policing, as far as housing, and of course, you know, bringing the city back to life. And part of that is like all those great voices you heard, you know, people want to live in the streets. Pedestrians want to be free in the streets and have that safety, and also just have that, you know, experience of being in a vibrant city, keeping the city vibrant, making sure it stays vibrant. Yeah.
Stephen Nesson is WNYC's transportation reporter. We'll have a link to that story we're talking about in our show notes, which just breaks down where all the leading candidates in the mayor's race stand on cars versus bikes versus people. And he'll be on the trains tonight, so say hi if you see him. Stephen, good luck.
Thank you, Kai.
Okay, so given how dramatic our debates over the streets can be, we figured we'd end the show with a little drama, too. A snippet from a forthcoming opera called A Marvelous Order, which is about two competing visions of the urban landscape. As we were planning the show, our producer, Carl Boisrod, just kept talking about this, so we had to bring it up. It's a collaboration between composer Judd Greenstein, Tracy K. Smith, who is a former U.S. Poet Laureate, and the director, Joshua Frankel. And it just gives you a sense of this fight as just the stuff of myth. The opera is about the battle between Robert Moses and Jane Jacobs. And in this scene, it depicts a public hearing in which Jacobs is really upset about a plan to build the Lower Manhattan Expressway through her home. It's performed by Megan Schubert. So we leave you with an expert from A Marvelous Order.
What kind of administration would even think of destroying the home? There will be anarchy. If Lomax is put through, there will be anarchy. If Lomax is put through, there will be anarchy. If Lomax is put through, there will be anarchy. If Lomax is put through, there will be anarchy. Anarchy.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. A special thanks to Stephen and his editor in the WNYC newsroom, Julianne Welby. They helped us think through this episode. Jared Paul mixed all that incredible street tape, including my bike ride. Hannes Brown mixed the podcast version. Kevin Bristow and Milton Ruiz were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Carl Boisrod, Emily Botine, Karen Frohman, and Christopher Wirth. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Verlin Williams is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And of course, I hope you'll join us for the live show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Till then, thanks for listening.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.